If you've ever experienced butterflies in your stomach under stress or pain and anxiety with a digestive issue, you've experienced the connection between the brain and the gut and vice versa. Hello, everyone. I'm Dr. Sharon Berquist, host of The Whole Health Cure, the podcast for people who want trustworthy, science-based information for using nutrition and lifestyle habits to become their healthiest and best selves. In this episode, I'm joined by one of the world's leading experts on the two-way communication between the brain and the gut, Dr. Emryn Meyer. We'll be talking about the role of this connection in health and disease and the mystery of how gut feelings and intuition originate. Emryn Meyer is a gastroenterologist, neuroscientist, and distinguished research professor in the Department of Medicine at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA, the executive director of the G. Oppenheimer Center for Neurobiology of Stress and Resilience at UCLA, and founding director of the Goodman Luskin Microbiome Center at UCLA. As one of the pioneers and leading researchers in the role of brain-gut interactions in health and chronic disease, in particular irritable bowel syndrome, his scientific contributions to basic and translational enteric neurobiology with wide-ranging applications in clinical GI diseases and disorders is unparalleled. He has published close to 410 scientific papers, co-edited 3 books, published the best-selling The Mind-Gut Connection book in 2016 and the Gut-Immune Connection book in June of 2021. He is the recipient of the 2016 David MacLean Award from the American Psychosomatic Society and the 2017 Ismar Boas Medal from the German Society of Gastroenterology and Metabolic Disease. His most recent work has focused on alterations in the bidirectional communications within the brain-gut microbiome system and their role in chronic inflammatory and functional diseases of the gut, obesity, and cognitive decline. Dr. Meyer, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for inviting me, Sharon. Nice to be here.
You have had such an incredibly illustrious career, and you're a pioneer in understanding the connection between the brain and the gut. Can you take us back to early in your career? How did you veer in this direction?
Yeah, so it's an interesting path. So I was not one of those people who always knew I was going to go into medicine. So it was an epic struggle in college. I was supposed to take over the business of my parents, been in the family for over many generations. And it was really kind of the coincidence. I got a really good GPA, and everybody said, you have to go to medical school. But from the beginning, I was more interested in the research aspect. I could not see myself as the GP who came to our house at the time. When we were kids, I could not see myself in that role. Yeah, so once I was in medical school, what interested me the most, don't ask me why, was from the beginning, this connection between the brain and the body. And you know, so in Germany, you have the option, you can either do a PhD-like thesis or you just get your MD by doing a review paper. And so I chose the former one, not realizing how difficult it was to find a mentor, you know, who was doing basics or cutting-edge science in mind-body or brain-body interactions. This is a long time ago, so today I think it would be easier to do that. And I ended up in the Physiological Research Institute and spent about 4 years studying the interactions between the brain and the cardiovascular system, the regional myocardial blood flow under stress. And so that was very exciting. I was sort of targeted towards a career in that direction, possibly cardiovascular surgery, because I had to do a lot of surgeries for these experimental models. And then I spent a summer at the Mass General in gastroenterology as an externship. That was an eye-opener. I thought this is both in two ways. One is that the patients I saw there, the GI patients, difficult patients, in my opinion, all had a mind component, which was not recognized or seen or acknowledged by the physicians. And the second one, it was just a very exciting time in gastroenterology. A lot of new things were happening. And so I came back, told my mentor, I'm not going to stay in his lab or continue the kind of research. And make a long story short, I basically applied all the things I've had learned and studied on the brain-gut communication from really the earliest days of my medical career as a gastroenterologist Today, this sounds sort of a very simple thing. At the time, this was not accepted as something, almost not as something legitimate. You know, people were in some ways at national meetings, our abstracts had a hard time getting traction and attention. And many of the key opinion leaders in this field of like irritable bowel syndrome or functional gastrointestinal disorders always emphasized this is a disease of the gut and had nothing to do with the brain. So, you know, now 40 years later, these disorders have been renamed disorders of brain-gut interactions, very satisfying, but sad that it took 40 years before that concept was. So this is a kind of a long story, a long answer to your question.
Right, but it's fascinating just trying to imagine 40 years ago. You know, you were so far ahead of the time, and culture is sometimes challenging when you're going against the status quo of the time. So it's interesting hearing the path. And ultimately, how did you get the traction? I imagine it was hard to get funding. It was hard to maybe even find colleagues. How did this area kind of grow and explode like it has?
Well, I mean, I started my research in my first year as junior faculty in a very reductionistic aspect of this. So at the time, as I mentioned, these disorders were considered disorders of the gut and smooth muscle particularly. And so I did a very ambitious grant proposal or one grant proposal on studying isolated smooth muscle cells with studying ion channels in these smooth muscle cells. That was very exciting from a research standpoint. The person had just gotten the Nobel Prize who invented this patch clamp technique. But then I realized, you know, whenever I went from the lab to see my patients, that these smooth muscle cells had very little to do with the symptoms that patients complained about. And so then, I mean, I had a very supportive mentor, late John Walsh, who sort of supported me in this. And I was ultimately able to get an R1 grant and an NIH grant in this. Yeah, so that was another thing. So brain imaging came about. This was, so it was an exciting time looking back. Today we take these things as granted, you know. So it was just the first papers that on brain imaging came out then. And I told my mentor, I said, this is what we have to do. You know, we have to look at the brain of these patients. And after a long ordeal to get somebody at UCLA in the Brain Imaging Center to think this is a valuable research project, we did our first studies. We got an NIH grant on this, you know, using brain imaging. And from that time on, we gradually built a reputation that you can use really cutting-edge science, you know, to study how the brain interacts with the gut and not just looking at the continuous evolution and modification of symptom criteria. So in this field, as you may know, a lot of people make their careers by reinterpreting every few years the criteria by which you diagnose, you know, these disorders and rename them and do studies to confirm the new classification. So yeah, I think the NIH was ultimately quite happy that they had somebody who actually took this in a different direction. Yeah, then it gradually got increasing attention. The biggest breakthrough came about 10 years ago when the first studies in mouse models came up about the role of the microbiome in signaling to the brain and influencing emotional behavior, anxiety-like behavior in these mouse models. And so that's what shifted the attention of, I think, the entire research field. The microbiome was something so fascinating that all the funding agencies switched towards supporting that kind of research. And so we then started to incorporate in our studies on brain-gut interactions, which was interesting by itself, switched to include the microbiome in all of our studies. And with the goal, which we have not completely reached yet, to see if in humans, just like in animals, you can see a relationship between who lives in our gut, what molecules they produce, and what effect this has on emotions and even, you know, cognitive function.
Mm-hmm. Which is just fascinating. In terms of origin, like as an origin story of why we as humans have that connection between the brain and the gut, you know, over millions of years this has evolved. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how it played a role throughout history and the ways the gut and the brain are connected? The microbiome, of course, is one. But what exactly are the other components of that connection?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very interesting story that in evolution, the first marine animals, you know, were basically floating digestive tubes, tiny animals that had an opening one end, opening the other end, and then there was a digestive tube inside of them. And that tube was wrapped into a net made up of nerve cells. And if you look at pictures of that from these ancient animals and look at the enteric nervous system, so basically our gut being surrounded by these networks of nerve cells that we call now the enteric nervous system. So that was like a very ancient design that, you know, that nature had come up with. And what the nerves on these marine animals did was twofold. One is they generated peristalsis. So when this creature took up something on one end to move it through its digestive system and out the other end, that's what these nerve nets did. And what it also did, it served the propulsion, because when the gut contracted, it would generate this, you know, this stream of water that propelled this animal. And then this was maintained for a long time until the development of a polar organization. So these were then animals that had a brain on one side. And when that happened, this gut brain basically was partially transformed in our central nervous system. And using many of the same molecules, the same receptors, same blueprints, I'd like to say. And that's why we have this sort of strange situation that the gut can communicate with the brain in very interesting, I mean, they speak the same language, these two organs. And equally interesting is that the early marine animals, at some point, some algae found their way into their gut. And I guess this was a very desirable place, because these microorganisms got free mechanism of travel and nutrients coming through. So this was the first gut microbiome, basically. And that also was maintained up to today, as we know. And so many of these microorganisms that settled in the gut from early on, they had a large gene pool, because the microbes in the ocean were there for millions of years, billions of years, really, before animals came. And they transferred some of this information, some of these genes, to the gut, to these nerve cells within the gut. So we actually got the alphabet or the communication system from the microbes, not the other way around. And so now we have a situation that the microbes, the gut-based brain or the enteric nervous system, and the brain, our central nervous system, all speak the same language. And that's why they communicate. And that's why I've made up, you know, in my opinion, the most important communication system that deals with homeostasis in the body of any other organs within the body. So this brain gut microbiome system is something that is not paralleled by any other organ.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and can you talk a little bit more about the homeostasis, like the balance and the role that plays in our health and in disease?
Yeah, obviously, you know, our bodies and brains are designed in a phenomenal, optimized way. You know, there was a long time of evolution that perfected everything from our stress system, our emotional system. I mean, all this was developed, tested, modified, you know, many, many times. So I think overall, we have a system that evolution has thought of for any circumstances that had occurred up to this point. And, you know, it's a system that responds to what I like to call perturbations in a way that it responds quickly and then shifts back to its basic state, to its balanced state. So this has basically, so like for example, just the stress system has saved the human race, you know, probably hundreds of thousands of times from extinction. The strange thing is that what we're experiencing today has never happened before in human history. And in our systems, particularly our stress systems that normally are the respond to any perturbation, homeostasis, are not really ideally equipped to deal with it. So they create something, if the stress is chronic, persistent, coming both from the environment, but also coming from our diet, our systems are not optimized and have not been optimized in evolution for this kind of new situation, you know, what people have called allostatic load, a chronic constant stimulation of the stress system. It then produces counterproductive effects like inflammation, or, you know, and inflammation has sort of become the, both in terms of the response of our bodies to our diet, our unhealthy diet, but also in response to the chronic psychological stress, where also, you know, chronic immune activation has sort of become a major a hallmark of it.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of a lot of the chronic diseases that we're facing today, can you talk more about this kind of common denominator of this immune activation?
Yeah, the common denominator, it's something that, you know, as a scientist, you're always skeptical if somebody comes up with sort of this unifying hypothesis, except in physics where you have the string theory, you know, you can explain almost everything with. So the common denominator is really an inappropriate engagement of the immune system. And it's important to know that 70% or more of the immune system is located in the gut. Most immune cells, also ones that come from the bone marrow, travel through the gut at some point and are influenced. And in the gut, they're just microns away from these 40 trillion microbes that, you know, have in a healthy gut are kept separate by this gut barrier, or intestinal barrier. But it's a very thin layer. I mean, any architect who would design this, you know, would not get this approved because it's just too dangerous. But it's lasted, you know, in our benefit for a long, long time. So, and the microbes, the main influence on the microbes is from the diet and from the chemicals that we ingest with our diet, and also from top down, from the brain, the negative emotions, stress. So it's not a surprise that these negative influences have led to a response of the microbiome. As the microbes, as I said earlier, have millions of genes, a lot more than we have human genes. So that makes them very adaptable, and they can adapt very quickly within, you know, in terms of a dietary change, within 24, 48 hours, the microbiome can adjust to that, but not our immune system. So now our immune system looks at this changed microbial ecosystem that has responded to the outside and to the influences, you know, from the brain and the diet. And the immune system sees it as a potential threat. And the immune system rings the alarm bells and, you know, activates, produces cytokines. And this doesn't just stay in the gut. This immune system activation, it spreads throughout the body, like to the adipose tissue, which then becomes almost like by contagion, another immune organ, which spreads to the brain, to the liver, to the intestine, causing this low-grade inflammation in all these organs. And so if you have, so this seems to be a common mechanism. And if you have the genetic predisposition for any specific diseases, be it from, you know, Parkinson's to Alzheimer's to colon cancer, you know, we know there are familial risk factors for developing any of these, then together with this chronic low-grade inflammation, you dramatically raise your risk. And because this phenomenon of this immune system activation is happening at young and younger age. So we've observed, you know, worldwide that, for example, the prevalence of IBD has been increasing in children and adolescents, the same with colon cancer, you know, having led gastroenterological associations to lower the age for colon cancer screening. So not only have these diseases increased in prevalence, but also the age of onset. And that goes in parallel with the, you know, the problems starting in childhood. You know, I don't know what the exact number is, but, you know, 20-40% of children in the US or in some other countries like Mexico are obese and have these, you know, metabolic syndrome, which is one of those inflammatory conditions. And so the more this happens in childhood, you know, the earlier we see these other diseases. And then there's another phenomenon that we know from animal models that these changes in the microbiome in response, for example, to a Western diet devoid in fiber and with other, you know, unhealthy components, this leads to changes in the microbiome, which is transmitted over generations, so it doesn't go away. If your parents had the problem and had a compromised microbiome, it's more likely that you start out with a compromised ecosystem as well. And that could be another reason why this happens at young and younger age. But it's really worrisome because I don't think as a society or as a medical system, people are really grasping this, except for some epidemiologists, but the consequences are really, in terms of the healthcare system.
Absolutely. Yeah, it seems unfair that you can inherit this based on your parents' or grandparents' habits. Knowing what we know about the immune activation in the gut and the link with disease, what can we do to prevent that? Like, what can we do to be healthier, stop the trends of younger and younger people getting disease?
Yeah, so that there's a lot of things that can be done, which some are easy, some are public health challenges. So, all this sort of starts really with the developing fetus in utero and the health of the mother. So obesity of the mother and metabolic syndrome in the mother will cause changes in this immune system in the mother, in the gut microbiome of the mother. That affects the brain development or the development of the fetus. The fetus is born, it goes through the vaginal canal and is inoculated by maternal microbes as a first sort of exposure. And then, as is common practice, women in the delivery room get antibiotics as prophylactic treatments. And then the exposure of children and infants to antibiotics is still mind-boggling, considering all that we know about it today. So, up to 10 doses by the age of, I forgot the exact number, by the age of 5 or something, that children, which they get primarily for non-indications. So they, mainly for viral upper respiratory tract infections. And so then, once the person has grown up, there's maybe the simplest things to do. So these are changes in the diet and changes in, taking care of your mind and your stress level and how you, not so much the stress level, which we often cannot really change, but the stress perception, what we perceive as stressful, what the brain perceives as stressful. Like all these techniques, mindfulness-based stress reduction that, fortunately, and other forms of meditation are becoming popular. And, I understand you're using that in your, clinical care. We have been doing this as well. And so the diet, I think it's almost, except for a few diseases, like in therapy refractory seizures in children, which seem to be responding to a ketogenic diet. But in general, the recommendation and the support from epidemiological studies, cross-sectional studies, but also from a few growing number now of intervention, controlled trial interventions, a largely plant-based diet has the benefits that it provides the microbes with the fiber, which they can convert into anti-inflammatory metabolites like short-chain fatty acids, and eliminating the excessive amounts of sugar that's in the diet, chemicals. We don't know what each of these components, what role they play in making the standard American diet so unhealthy. And it's probably the interaction of them. I mean, some people think it's avoiding red meat, but there was a recent meta-analysis, I think published in a prestigious journal, I think in Nature Medicine, that said this is not the case. Unprocessed meat does not play a major role. I doubt that because there's so much other evidence, that I've seen. Some people believe it's the sugar and some people believe it's the lack of fiber that, it's in my opinion, it is a combination. If you give more bad things that cause inflammation, and not enough of the ones that actually produce or stimulate your microbes to produce anti-inflammatory molecules, then that's the worst case scenario. And that's still what we continue to do,
Mm-hmm. Now, there are some labs that are popping up that are offering to test people's microbiome to, address this question of, do you have a healthy microbiome or not? What is your opinion on the testing that is commercially available?
Well, I should say, eventually this testing will be really important. I think this could, you know, if you're optimistic, you could say this will allow us to identify people who even in young age, they have an increased risk for early cognitive decline, for Parkinson's, colon cancer, you know, like all these diseases that we talked about. You might be able to detect this early on with stool testing. You also might be able at some point to be able to identify subgroups of patients to personalize your treatment. I personally don't think, for example, in terms of a personalized diet, probably less important. I mean, you can personalize it by taking out the few things that some people are sensitive or allergic to. Or if you have a disease like celiac disease, you want to take out gluten. But in general, you know, this, what I will call the default diet, is largely plant-based diet, really applies to everybody, you know, is beneficial. But in the future, it may be that if you have, like for a probiotic, for example, you know, you may want to test before and then say, okay, this individual will benefit from a particular probiotic. May also be something for evaluating before fecal microbial transplant. The problem is that most of these studies to date, there's a few exceptions, use the earliest form that was developed to identify the relative abundances of microbial species. It's called 16S sequencing. And that is not really a reliable way to come up, you know, what subtype you are, even though there's claims, like all these professional providers make all these claims based on your stool test. You have to take their supplement and you have to do this. And the field has moved rapidly to looking at actually what these microbes in your gut do. So it's a technique called shotgun metagenomics, where you see which genes are there and which genes are being expressed, and what are these microbes as a whole system, what are they producing? It's probably not important if you have one bad microbe, unless it's a pathogenic E. coli organism that you want to know, this one organism. But for this field of having a healthy microbiome, most likely multiple species and strains interact with each other and then create an output that is really what counts. And is this output in the form of metabolites or inflammatory mediators? When it reaches the brain, what does it do there in combination, you know? Not so, in my opinion, it will take I would say 90% of the testing that's available will not help you with your, you know, will not have consequences in what type of therapies or prediction of disease or, but I would say within the next, you know, possibly 5 years, we will be so far that this could become a routine exam. Just as, for example, measuring inflammatory mediators in your blood, which is a consequence of this, you know, unhealthy microbiome. Testing these inflammatory mediators, not our standard lab tests, but the ones we're now using in experimental settings, will become a standard that everybody could evaluate and say, you know, I'm in a state of low-grade immune activation and I need to do something, and my microbes are producing too many of these inflammatory mediators. I would bet my money on it. It will happen. The question is when. And you know, there's a lot of things that will fall by the wayside that are now sort of the talk on the internet, and you know, even many of the influencers who are hired by companies who want to promote their testing or their products, they will promote information that is not really, I would say, hold up to the scientific standards they would like to see.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. And I also want to ask you about gut feelings. So this is just such a fascinating area because, you know, I think we all have this intuition and we lean into it. But I also think that we're told, you know, be logical, don't just make decisions based on emotions. So how do these intuitions, these gut feelings originate? And should, what is your opinion on, should you make life decisions based on them?
Yeah, no, that's an interesting question. And, you know, I've gone through being a scientist, like I always test my own hypotheses, and if I don't think they really fit reality, I'm happy to abandon them. But I mean, there are situations, many situations, where people have made gut-based decisions, like this Russian military guy, you know, when there was an event in the 60s, where he saw on his radar screen these ICBMs coming in towards Moscow, and which was a mistake in their system, and he did not trigger the red button, which he would have been obliged to, you know, to launch a counterstrike by Russian nuclear missiles. And obviously he saved a big portion of mankind. He recently passed away. And in my personal life, I've made gut-based decisions because I just could not come up with a rational way of making these decisions, career decisions particularly, for me has always been the most difficult ones. And yeah, I mean, looking back, I think it always guided me in the right direction, even though often it seemed like people around me were shocked by me doing these, you know, making these seemingly irrational decisions. And so I came up with this idea, and this, I think it is a hypothesis, that what happens over a lifetime, so every emotion, every stress, every emotional experience leaves, always has a component, because the brain sends signals to, you know, to the gut and the microbes. And so each of these emotional moments is encoded in signals from your gut feelings, and also, you know, from what happened. So you have these probably millions, billions of little video clips somewhere stored in your nervous system. And what happens when you make a decision, a gut-based decision, you don't go through this lengthy, slow step that happens in your prefrontal cortex, where you go through the logic, but you access, just like with a search engine, you know, that vast database that you have inside of you. And then you make that decision based on the immediate result, just like, you know, when you type in the first two letters in a Google search that knows you already knows what you're looking for, you know. So it's, you could have these insights, these gut-based insights, spontaneously. And when I was writing my first book, I couldn't believe, when I paid attention to the media, how many people each day, from politicians to professional sports athletes, how many people said, I made this based on a gut-based decision, or, you know, based on my gut feelings. So it's definitely something that a lot of people experience. And I think we have a model that, I mean, our model is always based on the machines that we create and that we are fascinated by, you know. And right now it is these mega computers and search engines that can do amazing things in fractions of a millisecond. It will change, I think, as our understanding of consciousness and phenomena around consciousness and the brain, you know, beyond rational thought, will expand. I think we'll expand these models as well of intuition. But then there's one caveat. I would say, if your gut feelings are programmed in a way that you experienced a lot of traumatic events from early on, and negative events, they're sort of biased more towards the making decisions influenced by anxiety and fear and, you know, projections that are not unbiased, that they're really influenced more by this underlying fear. And if you're a person with an anxiety disorder, it's probably not a good idea to always follow your gut feelings, because a lot of times they will lead you in a direction of avoidance, or, you know, not the right decision for you, the best decision for you. It's a fascinating field, you know, a fascinating topic, and I'm sure it will evolve as our understanding of the brain and the consciousness evolves over time.
Wow. Emran, I want to, first of all, thank you for the incredible contributions you've made to this field and how much you have helped our understanding present day of the gut and the brain interaction. So thank you for being a pioneer in this area. Is there anything you'd like to share with our listeners that we haven't had a chance to talk about?
I mean, I think you touched upon the most, you know, pertinent topics, really. I think, yeah, I mean, for me personally, I want to share this. So again, following my gut feelings that I'm in the process of this transition from my exclusively academic career to one promoting these insights and messages to a large audience as possible. because there's just so much misinformation out there. You definitely want a few people within the medical community who has a similar goal. And, I've been really been enjoying interacting with you on this and hope we'll do more of this in the future. But, this is something I think people first have to learn it. Like before making these changes in the diet, in lifestyle, I think there's a learning process. You can't just say, I want to lose weight after the holidays because I know I'm going to gain 5 pounds. I mean, that's just not, it's not relevant really in the bigger picture. If you make any of these changes, some of them are difficult lifestyle changes. They have to be permanent in order to be effective. And helping this process, educational process, I think that's sort of become a very important goal for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you're doing a tremendous job communicating a lot of really complicated information. So thank you for listening to your gut intuition and doing that work.
Thanks, Sharon, for having me on your show, and I really enjoyed it. Hopefully we can do it again in the future.
Yeah, love that.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode and share it with a friend. I really love hearing feedback, so please leave a review to let me know what you think and rate this podcast. The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by Emory Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness and is copyrighted by Emory University. Until next time, do something to help improve your whole health naturally.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.